Endowment for the Arts. Art works.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, coming up today, we'll talk with one of the nation's top investigative reporters about the tax plan that's making its way through Congress and about Donald Trump's secret business history. And we'll meet a doctor who travels the world, especially to developing countries, rescuing children from heart problems that are easily solvable with modern medicine. But first, one listener comment about yesterday's program, which we played a portion of Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore's interview with conservative commentator Sean Hannity about the allegations that Moore sexually harassed teenage girls. Here's what one listener had to say.
Hi, I'd like to leave a comment about Monday's show, Radioactivity, on Roy Moore and the brave women who have come forward about his behavior toward the teenagers. What saddens me is the number of men who seem skeptical or unwilling, and they keep the caveat, if true. And the very skepticism is the reason why women, especially young women, are fearful to come forward and speak of what has happened to them when they get molested, approached, abused by men like this, especially if the man is someone in position of authority. That's so fearful to a 14-year-old, 15-year-old, any woman, really, at any age, especially when it's a person, as Moore is, and has been in a position of authority. It's really sad that there's not more understanding of what this does to young people, and men and women who've gone through this. Anyway, thank you very much. Good show.
Listener comment that came in after yesterday's program. Before we meet our first guest this morning, there was another shooting in East Tampa that Tampa police say may be linked to a serial killer who in the last 6 weeks has killed three other people in the Seminole Heights neighborhood. This morning's murder took place near Nebraska and Caracas streets, and now police are scouring the nearby neighborhoods trying to find the killer. WMNF Sean Canan spoke with Tampa police spokesperson Steve Hegarty about what happened this morning.
He was shot. Witnesses gave us a description of what they thought was the suspect. So at this point, we are looking for a suspect who's been described as maybe 6 foot 2, thin, black male, dressed all in black. The victim is being identified as a 60-year-old man by the name of Ronald Felton, F-E-L-T-O-N. Apparently, he was by himself. Apparently, he was crossing the street, and as I said, he was shot, and we found him dead in the street. We got the call at about 4:51, and within, like, less than a minute, one of our sergeants was on the scene.
The way you described the suspect, could it be the same person in the video that we saw from the earlier?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because a lot of people have seen the video, and I interpret the video to be someone who's relatively tall and relatively thin, so it is possible that that's the person. Remember that when we released the video, we said we don't know if this is a suspect or if it's just a witness, because it's very possible that they saw something and then ran in the other direction. That's still a possibility, but the description that we're getting here might square with that.
That's Tampa Police spokesperson Steve Hegarty speaking with WMNF Sean Canan this morning about the latest shooting in East Tampa. We'll have more at 3:30 about what the police are discovering about the murder this morning. Well, Dr. Aubin Merrith is with us right now. He's with a Tampa-based nonprofit called CardioStart, which has been performing free heart surgeries in undeveloped countries for 30 years. More than 1,500 participants have volunteered on missions overseas, unpaid missions, and they've joined from many countries. And this nonprofit is based right here in the Tampa Bay area. And Dr. Merrith, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Rob, for including me on the program. Very much appreciate it.
Tell us more about how you came to start the CardioStart.
The first observation I had was that we were wasting a great number of items in the operating room and in the ward at the hospitals I'd worked at. And I've worked in four healthcare systems in the world, in the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, and the United States. And I felt that we could reuse some of the items, and we could also take advantage of those which had been thrown out. A lot of the problems are that companies will make a product and then the surgeons or physicians will decide that that product is either obsolete or has been superseded by a better one. So we were the lucky recipients of some items that were in perfectly good condition and could be used. And we have done just under 1,000 cases over these years. We focus on education, but those cases have been done without having purchased a single item of equipment.
Hmm. Do hospitals in developing nations generally not have these materials?
Yes, it's one of the biggest problems they face is that the budget needs are astonishingly high. I mean, when we went to Nicaragua some years ago, the budget for that hospital with a huge, huge catchment area, $1 million, was $10,000 per annum. So you can do nothing with that of any consequence.
Hmm. So tell me about the kinds of surgeries you perform when you go overseas, when you go to these developing nations.
We do quite complex operations, but the operations range from pediatric congenital, pediatric rheumatic fever valve cases, and adult acquired and adult congenital, because some of the people with heart disease aren't picked up till they're joining the military.
Hmm. I saw one surgery on video that showed a young woman, 27 years old, who had tuberculosis, and she was in, I think it was Nigeria, and the scarring of the tuberculosis had interfered with her heart function, and so that was the surgery to try to take away some of the scarring.
Yes, and it was extremely successful. It was performed by a colleague, Dr. Emily Farkas, and it's a constrictive pericarditis, and what it does is it sort of holds the heart like a jacket would, a very tight jacket around the chest, so it prevents it from contracting, and so these patients do very badly on exercise, and they become progressively worse, mm-hmm. and it's a very treatable condition that usually doesn't come back.
So in developing nations, is the problem the lack of sophistication, too, in terms of their medical schools? Do they have the trained cardiosurgeons in developing nations?
Yes and no. Actually, the majority of surgeons that we meet who represent the local teams, they're actually highly skilled. They're immensely frustrated, and they're shorthanded, rather like giving a chef no equipment to use to make a nice meal. Some are not trained in the more advanced lesions that we can fix, so they need to be taught. And that's the main thrust of the charity, is education, providing the equipment, and helping them advance their program.
So with these doctors practicing surgery next to you, next to the doctors that come in from CardioStart, they're learning certain skills.
Very much so, and one thing that you might find interesting is that we generally don't do the operations ourselves. We teach them standing to the right or the opposite the local surgeon so that they're empowered. It's very similar to teaching a child or a young man how to ride a motorbike. You can do all you like and say, I'll show you how I do this, but in the end, they've got to get on the saddle and you've got to let go of that back and give them a chance to find the concept of balance.
Well, we're talking with Dr. Abin Marath. He's the founder of a nonprofit that's based right here in the Tampa Bay area, CardioStart International. And they've been performing free heart surgeries in underdeveloped countries for the past 30 years. Did you teach at the local university? Did you teach at the medical school at USF?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And now you're retired.
Well, I'm trying to retire, but I'm busy.
How big is the need in developing nations?
The need is enormous. For instance, if you take a center in the United States, you would expect that center to serve around 1,200 patients in a year. In Africa, we've been to three locations in Africa, you would probably expect to accomplish 18. And so it's absolutely absurd. 92 or 93% of the world does not have a proper cardiothoracic facility. It hasn't advanced yet. And so it's a terrible problem worldwide.
What happens if these people aren't treated by the surgery in developing nations? What happens to them?
The children die late, so it's worse than cancer, which can take you away quite quickly. They take sometimes 10, 20 years to die, but they remorselessly go that way. With adults, it's actually more tragic because a lot of these adults will get acquired disease, particularly rheumatic valve disease, which we hardly see in the United States, and they will have to stop work. So suddenly one person's illness affects 5, 6, 7 members of the family because they're not able to do the work they normally would do.
Would it be fair to say that if they were in the U.S. and they had access to treatment and care, that these would be fairly simple cardiac procedures?
Yes, that would be a correct statement.
Well, we're talking about CardioStart International, and our email address here is dj@wmnf.org. Dr. Aubin Marath is the founder of CardioStart, which is based right here in the Tampa Bay area. So you get support from local hospitals to go overseas to these developed nations?
No, we get support from two local hospitals that provide equipment, and that's been a tremendous help to the logistical program. We've sent over 15 containers out of Tampa in the last few years. So that's been a success out of the house that we use. Mm-hmm. Our greatest problem is obviously financial. We none of us receive any income from this. I've never taken expenses or an income. And I have my accountant here next to me to confirm that. But in addition, we have to pay for our own flights, medications, and so these can be a real problem.
So the accountant will testify here that your budget is quite low.
Very low, unfortunately. I've just done a mission to the Dominican Republic. Our costs were $350.
Why do you do it?
I think I do it. The charity is not a religious or a politically motivated organization, but I think all of us, not just myself, we'll do it because of the silliness of waste. It offends us all to see someone hurting. I think it's a very uncomfortable feeling to watch someone suffer and feel that you can do nothing about it. On the other hand, if you do see suffering and you can do something about it, it's an intoxicating experience. Very strong personal satisfaction comes from that.
You've been doing this for 30 years. What are the countries that you've traveled to and your other volunteers have traveled to perform these surgeries?
Well, the list is long. It's 35. But just to give you an example of the integrity and the sense of purpose of our volunteers, we were in Vietnam unintentionally during the typhoon, the largest typhoon that year, 3 years ago in Hue. And the American vets that came with us were very strongly and warmly received. We were in Nepal, again, unintentionally during their earthquake 2-3 years ago now. That was a great success, the mission, despite the fact that we had all these natural disasters going on. And we've been in Peru at a similar time when they've had a very severe earthquake in southern Peru, in Arequipa.
So when you're there during these disaster times, I imagine you're also doing like emergency medical treatment.
That's absolutely true. And we have a small section of the charity team that will devote themselves to outreach and to giving advice on trauma and on what we call CPR, cardiopulmonary resuscitation techniques.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the reasons I asked you here was that I had heard from your accountant the great work that you had done, and I was interested to find out that your budget was so low and that you have a very low profile, too, here in the Bay Area. I think probably when you go to those countries, that you're warmly welcomed by the people in those countries. But
yes.
Here in the U.S., I mean, I've lived here for 38 years, and I got to say, for some reason, I've missed this charity. So if people are in the medical field, if they're nurses or if they're surgeons, can they volunteer?
The answer is yes. It's an open-door charity. It's not a club. So anybody can volunteer. In the medical aspect, they can volunteer locally and or they can come on missions. Those who are non-medical can help us with our logistical program. Those who have any financial wherewithal, we're begging always for financial support. Right now, I have a very worthy young lady who is working for free, having just graduated from University of South Florida, and I can't pay her. And she's so deserving of it. Like any young person coming out with a degree, she deserves a chance. And so if anybody has $20,000 to spare, I would use it very usefully.
How can people get in touch with you? How can people get in touch if they want to make a donation or if they want to volunteer?
Sure. We have the telephone number and the website available, and we can readily receive that help. And we can also acknowledge it. It'll be a tax write-off donation opportunity. But because they know that the charity is low profile, they can be reassured that the money will go to the purposes described and they'll get a report on that.
Mm-hmm. What's that phone number?
The phone number is 813-304-2163.
So where do you, do countries call you up? Do you get calls from cities around the world saying, Dr. Marath, we need a cardiac surgeon to come to our country because we've got a lot of people in need? Do people call you up?
Yes and no. We never solicit to go to a country, but the invitations actually exceed our ability to help. People have, you know, thankfully given us the reputation we now have of delivering. We set up the programs on invitation. The invitation has to have the Ministry of Health support. And secondly, we do a 25-page questionnaire prior to going there. I've just had a two-member team go to Myanmar, which, as you know, is in the public eye at the moment from the atrocities being inflicted on a minority group in their own nation. But we go there with the attitude that if there is a problem, it can only be eased by the warmth and goodwill that medical health care can provide without any political strings attached.
Do you also work in the U.S.? Do you go to parts of the U.S. where they need cardiac surgery?
I would if they were, but actually the United States is generally well served. There are some regional shortcomings, and of course some people are in desperate need because they have no insurance or poor insurance status, but that's a different kind of political healthcare issue that we can't get involved in.
Yeah, and there was just a remote access medical group in Bradenton last weekend. So where are you headed next? What countries are you planning to go to next?
Sure, I've just come back from the Dominican Republic, so there will be a Dominican Republic return mission in April in which we'll be focusing on adult cardiac surgery by my colleague, Dr. Mariano Brizio from New Jersey. He's with the university system up there. We have Honduras and Ecuador already secured, but the dates have just got to be gelled in March and April. Nepal is also going to be a certainty, and Nigeria. Brazil will take place in the summer, and that will be in the northern Amazonian area. And as I've just mentioned, Myanmar is also likely to take place simultaneously in March with a different team.
So your biggest need is cardiac surgeons?
Our biggest need is financial.
Financial.
Yeah,
okay.
Financial support has been the biggest problem.
All right. So we're talking with Dr. Abin Marith, who is the founder of CardioStart International. They have been around for 30 years, based in the Tampa Bay area. They've been performing free heart surgeries in undeveloped countries for 30 years. They performed more than 3,000 procedures, including 902 free heart surgeries have been performed, and containers have been shipped from the Tampa Bay area containing medical supplies and equipment. So, so the biggest need is money, and again, that phone number that you gave before, 813-304-2163, and if people want to volunteer, can they volunteer? If they're medical professionals, can they volunteer for a trip?
They can, and even non-medical volunteers can volunteer. We pay for the lodging and the meals provided on the mission, so a lot of people are actually curious to see the countries, and they regard this as part of it. And sometimes people will extend beyond the allotted time for the mission to enjoy a vacation experience beyond that. Yeah. So they're excited because most people go into medicine in all its forms with an objective that's altruistic. They get bogged down with all the bureaucracy and the legal issues, but that's what they always wanted to do. So it's been a very good shoe-in for some people.
Okay, and again, they can call that number and go to the CardioStart website, which is
www.cardiostart.org.
All right. Well, Dr. Marith, is there anything else that you'd like to add to this?
We need help at the facility. We've got several young people, which is an incredible statement for the next generation, from University of South Florida and from individuals in the Tampa Bay area. We would love to see more of them coming out to help at the warehouse here in Tampa. We also have a second warehouse in Oregon, but I'm not going to ask anybody to come from Tampa to Oregon in this climatic condition.
We have some listeners online in Oregon, so maybe they'll call you up. 813-304-2163. And, well, Dr. Marith, thank you so much for coming by and telling us about CardioStart International. What a great service. It sounds like Doctors Without Borders to me. It sounds like that kind of charity.
Yeah, it's very similar, except we're highly specialized, whereas Medicine Without Borders focuses on field medicine and emergency response. It's a brilliant organization. We didn't fashion it after them, but we have made these specialties that encompass about 10 different specialties within cardiac surgery and cardiology. We've made them possible for the experts in these areas to find a compassionate outlet, if you like.
Well, thank you for doing what you do.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. We'll post a link to the phone number and also to the website on our website this afternoon. This is WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg. In a moment, we're going to talk with one of the country's leading investigative journalists. From Oliver Mitsukudzi. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Our next guest is one of the country's leading investigative reporters. He's also an expert on the nation's tax system. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001. He's covered news for some of the nation's top newspapers, including the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's David K. Johnston, who covered Donald Trump's business dealings. He's been doing that for more than 30 years. His latest book is The Making of Donald Trump. It's just been issued in paperback, and he joins us on the phone right now. David K. Johnston, welcome back to WMNF. Nice to have you here. Thank you for coming on.
Rob, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. I want to ask you, first of all, about the president's trip before we launch into President Trump's career. But what do you make of the president's trip overseas?
During the campaign, Donald Trump said he intended to start wars and that he would use nuclear weapons. Of course we're going to use nukes, he said. And it's been relied on meeting with a bunch of the generals. You know, he said, why don't we use nuclear weapons? We've got them. Why don't we use them? Which tells you he doesn't know anything about nuclear weapons, which are defensive. The White House announced not long after he was president that every single campaign promise without exception was going to be fulfilled. And I believe that Donald is trying to provoke an excuse to be able to use nuclear weapons against somebody, North Korea being the principal target at the moment. Look at where he went and who he spoke to on this trip. He's trying to find a way to do this because in his mind that makes him more important. This is a man who said, you know, that if a rocket man, as he called the dictator in North Korea, doesn't behave the way Donald thinks he should, he implied that he would kill all 25 million North Koreans.
Well, so this goes to a point in your book.
That's the thing I think is most important about the trip, Rob.
All right. So this goes to a point in your book that you think that President Trump really doesn't know anything about the job. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I've known Donald for years. I have talked with him about things. You know, he claims to be the world's greatest expert on 21 subjects. One of those subjects is taxes, on which I am a very well-known authority. I just spoke. It was the keynote address in Australia, the tax conference there. And Donald clearly doesn't know these things. He, on his first foreign trip, goes to Saudi Arabia and praises the Saudis for fighting against terrorism and a tax cutter. Well, the number one funders of terrorism in the world are the Saudis, and Qatar is where we have our most important military base in the Middle East. Donald has a long history of statements that just make it clear he doesn't know what he's talking about. And when he gets called on some of them, as occasionally happens when a reporter or someone else gets on something, he says, well, I read that, or somebody told me that, or it was on the Internet, because he just makes stuff up. Donald creates his own reality.
And that was true when you were covering him for the Philadelphia Inquirer and you were going to Atlantic City in New Jersey. And is that pretty much what you found?
Oh, yeah. The 3 years I spent in Atlantic City and wrote a book back then that Donald is heavily in called Temples of Chance, I saw repeatedly that he would just make stuff up. He didn't. I was told right off by one of his competitors that he didn't know anything about the casino business. He owned two casinos at the time. And I was skeptical about this, but the regulator said Donald is not an operator. And then Donald's own guys, once they trusted me, said, yeah, Donald doesn't know anything about the casino business. He knows how to be an impresario, and he knows how to extract cash from the business. And his casinos were among the least profitable. They were among the first to close because he's not a competent businessman. He's a cash extractor. He's a guy who goes in, makes a deal with somebody, rips them off, doesn't pay them as promised, doesn't pay workers. There have been judicial findings he doesn't do that, doesn't pay vendors, and then he moves on to the next target.
We're talking with David K. Johnston. We're going to get into his book, The Making of Donald Trump. It's just been reissued in paperback, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. All right, so President Trump has suggested that he's worth $10 billion and that he ran a big company, and therefore he's got the skills to run the country. And is there a relationship? The cabinet, you know, there's about 12 cabinet members. Each of them has a budget of several hundred billion dollars. Is there a relationship between Donald Trump's business and his expertise in running that business, if I could use that word, and running the U.S. government?
Well, Donald doesn't run the businesses. He hires people who run them for him. And he doesn't know anything about government. Donald had not done a single day of public service prior to January 20th of this year. And remember, he ran for office. He ran for office basically on the policies laid out in my trilogy. It was a best-selling, award-winning trilogy of Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and The Fine Print about how the 90% are being oppressed by policies that favor the 1%, or even more so, the top tenth of 1%. And he said he was going to drain the swamp. He then proceeded to put six Goldman Sachs people in high-level positions, including the cabinet. He's taken a whole series of actions that are absolutely antithetical to the interests of workers and to safety. And all of this goes to that it's a fraud. And by the way, he said he was worth $10 billion, but, you know, he filed a financial statement this year. First, he asked if he could file it without signing it under penalty of perjury. Was told he had to sign it. It doesn't show $10 billion, or as he once claimed, more than $11 billion. It shows $1.4 billion. And if you then take every one of his other properties that are they top out in the paperwork at $50 million and double it, assume they're double, you don't get to $2 billion. It's nowhere near the $10 billion, and that's another example of Donald just makes it up. In fact, he testified under oath that he determines his net worth based on his emotions, under oath. And he was asked, really? Is that how you do it? And yes, he said, it depends on his mood. If he's feeling good, then his net worth goes up. I think the proper word to describe that is delusional.
Mm. Do we know how much debt Donald Trump and his hundreds of companies are carrying? Do we have any idea how much he's in hock to either banks or other interests?
Well, we know that his largest single creditor is Deutsche Bank, which has already been fined over $600 million for laundering money for the Russian oligarchs. And Donald, of course, has received huge amounts of money from the Russian oligarchs that I detail in the book in deals that don't make any economic sense. We don't know the full extent of his indebtedness because the way the government disclosure rules are written, there's more loophole there than substance. We know he's indebted somewhat to the two biggest banks in China, which, of course, are owned by the Chinese government. And you'll notice that since coming into office, Donald has completely reversed his position on China and been very supportive of them. And we know that he does still have loans from Deutsche Bank, and we know that Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, was the vice chairman of the Bank of Cyprus, where the other vice chairman was an appointee of Vladimir Putin, and where they hired to run the bank, whose principal business was laundering money for Russian oligarchs, the former head of Deutsche Bank.
So do you think that the Mueller investigation, I guess we know the Mueller investigation is looking into the Cyprus bank, right?
Yes. Well, Mueller has persuaded 17 former prosecutors who in private practice were all making more than $1 million a year, and I wouldn't be surprised if some of them were making 10 or 15, to quit their lucrative private practices and take a prosecutor's salary of about $180,000. And the only reason they did that was Mueller convinced them that this is the most important thing they will do in their life. Mueller is very focused, as he was directed to be, on the Russia stuff. And here's something a lot of people have missed, Rob. If you go back and reread that email that Donald Trump Jr. denied existed, and the family then put out six different statements trying to explain it away, of the Russian Crown Prosecutor, the Attorney General for the Kremlin, helping the Trump campaign. That memo indicates they were already helping them. It talks about the dirt they wanted to deliver on Hillary Clinton as part of the Russian government's efforts to help. Of course they were helping them, and they knew they were being helped. And by the way, if you're involved in a presidential campaign or any political campaign and a hostile foreign power calls up and offers you help, there is only one appropriate thing to do. You pick up the phone, you dial the FBI, and you say, I need counterintelligence. You don't lie, deny, cover up, and that's what the Trumps have done.
We're talking with David K. Johnston, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, about his new book, The Making of Donald Trump. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. This China thing has really got me bugged because the president spoke very strongly about taking on China during the campaign. You know, I think he knows that a lot of American workers are hurt. They'd like manufacturing jobs back. Trump himself makes his clothes over in China. Ivanka Trump makes purses over in China, too. Labor investigators who were going to inspect Ivanka Trump's Chinese factories to see look at working conditions and pay conditions were arrested by the Chinese this year. When Donald Trump went to China just a few days ago, he seemed to be treated like like a king, and he didn't really speak out about working conditions or on behalf of American workers when he was there. And then there were several favorable trademark decisions in favor of the Trump family given by the Chinese since President Trump took office. What do you make of the China stuff in Donald Trump?
Yeah, it's more than 100 trade and service marks since he took office to Trump and Ivanka and the various entities. Well, this is a good example of how Donald doesn't know what he's doing. I always say that I never say he earned a degree in economics. He was given one by Penn. He was asked under oath questions about economics in lawsuits that make it clear he has no idea about the most basics of economics. Donald, when he came into office, killed the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was the proposed trade agreement between 12 Pacific Rim countries, including America. Now, I was one of the most prominent critics of that proposed agreement, which I thought needed to be rewritten, but I also understood it was to contain China's ambitions. Now the TPP is dead. China has the RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Plan, of 16 countries, including India. And Chinese diplomats are going all over the world and saying, why are you paying any attention to Washington? America's in decline. Look who's in their White House. You should reorient your economic and other interests to Beijing. And the Chinese have benefited more from Donald Trump's getting rid of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and not replacing with anything than anything else anyone in the world has done since Nixon went to China.
Mm. Does it improve American workers' position at all by having the Chinese outside or having the U.S. Outside the TPP?
No, that's a good question, Rob. Absolutely not. And Donald has done a whole series of actions that are inimical to the interests of workers. We have delayed safety dealing with beryllium and silica dust. Silica dust was something the Romans knew was deadly. He's canceled the plan to require that train conductors be tested for sleep apnea, even though we've had a whole bunch of people die. We test airline pilots for it, but we're not going to test, Trump says, truck drivers and train operators for sleep apnea because it would be too costly. He has changed an overtime rule that will hurt the wages of many workers. They took down at one point the material about workers killed on the job. Now they've partially restored some of it. And there has been no indication of any significant enforcement of worker safety laws. They've dropped a number of cases. Donald ran for office saying, I'm your hero, I'm your champion, I'm going to go to Washington and I'm going to stop this, the elites cleaning your pockets, and instead, he's done the exact opposite.
Mm. We're talking with David K. Johnson. He's the author of a new book that's just out in paperback called The Making of Donald Trump. David has covered Donald Trump for more than 30 years as an investigative reporter. He formerly worked for the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer. And David, I want to ask you about the tax plan that's being making its way through Congress. The President Trump says that we have one of the highest corporate tax rates in the world, and if we cut those corporate taxes, we're going to see job expansion in the U.S. What do you make of that?
Well, there's absolutely zero evidence that cutting the corporate tax rate leads to more jobs. The statutory rate of 35% is the highest in the world. That's a true statement. But what I've shown, and everybody in the tax business knows, is that multinational companies like General Electric and Apple literally turn a profit off the corporate income tax system because of rules this bill doesn't address that allow them to defer their taxes. And you know, Rob, if you could take all the money withheld from your paycheck this year and defer payment for 30 years and invest it and then just pay the nominal amount, no adjustment for inflation or interest, you think you might get rich off just that alone? Well, that's what these companies do. They defer paying their taxes.
Mm.
And in many ways, the inner provisions of the bill, and I say this as someone who, I'm not a lawyer, but I teach tax law at a law school, they would actually worsen the situation for American workers. They would encourage more jobs to be conducted offshore. So this whole bill even the Republicans are divided about it in Congress. And remember that in September of 2015, Donald Trump held a press conference at Trump Tower. He said he had a complete ready-to-go tax plan, had been vetted by the greatest experts in the world. They wouldn't name a single person who had vetted it. And on January 20th, it would be introduced, and it would become law, just bingo. Well, of course, we now know there was no tax plan of any kind. They first put forth a 100-word statement in April that read like a shopping list for Goldman Sachs clients who want to avoid paying taxes. Then they came up with 8 pages and a cover sheet. And the bill they finally introduced, what it really does is it says, well, we want to provide more help for families, so we're going to take away medical deductions from old people. It just transfers things around. It's not reform, and it adds to the federal debt at least $1.5 trillion. And remember, Donald ran saying the federal debt is too high. We need to cut it. This bill would increase it.
Are corporations hurting right now? Is this the right time?
Oh, my goodness, no. Corporate profits have been now for a number of years at incredibly high levels. Remember that in March of 2009, the stock market hit its low point, and the Dow was at about 6,800. It's now at 22,000. There's never been anything like this in history. Corporate profits are at record high levels. Corporate income taxes, there is a real issue with corporate income taxes, and that is that domestic companies, and I'm a founder of a tiny little domestic corporation with 25 employees, we get fully and completely taxed by the federal government, just like workers do. But multinational companies like Apple and Nike and Hilton, they get to defer their taxes. And when they do that, they turn the burden of the income tax into a profit center, and it gives them an unfair competitive advantage against domestic businesses, many of which, like mine, are family-owned businesses.
Mm. Now, I see a lot of ads on TV. I don't know if you've seen these ads that say that advocate for the tax changes that Congress is proposing, and you see working class families and middle class families and business owners saying that these tax changes, tax cuts, are going to help the American worker. Have you seen those ads, and what do you make of those ads?
Well, I've seen some of those ads, and the Tax Policy Center is a center somewhat to the left group that has a computer model of taxes that has proven very accurate in the years they have developed it. And their model shows half the benefits go to the top 1%, which starts at about $600,000 currently. And within that, most of the benefits go to the tenth of 1%, which is people who are essentially above $2 million of income. At the $40,000, $50,000 level of income, your tax savings would be, on average, about $400, and about one family in six would see their taxes go up, not down. There's been no public hearings held on this tax plan. This is the single biggest element of our economy is taxes. Why are we doing this in secret? Why were there no Democrats involved in the negotiation? Why were lobbyists left and right involved? Why did the Kevin Brady, who's in charge of the tax bill, the Texas congressman, why did he issue a 33-page adjustment to it that reads like it was written by corporate lobbyists? This is not a tax bill designed to in any way promote economic growth. It's a tax bill designed to support what key donors want. And a number of the Republicans have come out and said publicly, they've been told by big donors, if you don't pass a tax bill that has what I wanted, don't ever ask for any more money. So that's what's going on here, is not tax reform. It's tax cut for the very richest and a few crumbs for the hoi polloi.
Our guest is David K. Johnston. He's an investigative reporter. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001. He's also, as a reporter, has covered taxes and Donald Trump. He's one of the country's leading experts on taxes. So I want to ask Congress, I don't know if anybody's ever done this, but if the promise is that if you cut corporate taxes and you see these ads saying, well, the money's going to go to benefit workers, it's going to help expand the middle class, I want to say to Congress, give me a year's guarantee that those corporations will reinvest that money in good-paying jobs here in the U.S. and that that the benefits of the tax cuts will inure to the people of the country. And if it doesn't happen, I want to say to them, don't do it. You know, just repeal them if the corporations don't turn around and give that money to the workers.
Right. Well, there are circumstances, economic circumstances, under which a tax cut can have a job-stimulative effect. That isn't one of them right now. Look at Apple. Apple's got more than $260 billion, as in more than a quarter of a trillion, sitting in offshore accounts as idle cash. The need in this country is for jobs, without question. That requires investment. But lowering the tax rate doesn't do that. There's no direct connection to that whatsoever. And corporate profits are near record levels and have been now for a number of years. That'll probably start to soften because the economy is starting to plateau out. Business cycles have never been repealed, and we've been in the current one now since July 1 of 2009. That's when the last recession officially ended. But there's just no connection here whatsoever. And by the way, you know, I've never hired a worker for a tax cut. Every worker I've hired in my life, it's because I had work that needed to be done, whether it was in our hotel management company, more customers, so we needed more chambermaids, or in my books and lecture business, needing research done. That's when you hire people when you have demand for your services and your goods, and you need to fulfill that. You don't hire people because of a tax cut. That's just loony.
A lot of people, I think, are on the conservative side are supporting the tax cuts because they say it'll end up reducing the federal deficit. You said a moment ago that it's going to actually increase the federal deficit by $1.5 trillion. Overall, what's the track record when it comes to tax cuts and whether or not tax cuts increase or decrease the federal deficit?
Well, I want to be very careful that I'm not talking about causality, just what actually happened, all right? The last 4 years of the Clinton administration, after we raised taxes on ordinary income and cut taxes on investment, we had budget surpluses. Budget surpluses. Remember when George Bush and Al Gore were running? That was one of the big issues. And Gore's contention was we should keep the surpluses and pay down the federal debt. And the position taken by George W. Bush was no. We have such huge surpluses. Well, even bigger ones if we cut taxes. There is no consistent and clear connection between tax rate cuts and economic growth. There is a fair amount of evidence that raising taxes has actually led to more jobs and more income, which is totally counterintuitive, and I understand that, and I'd say this as somebody who studied economics at the doctoral level at the University of Chicago, but if you look at the data year by year, and I've written about this in my other books, cutting taxes has not led to more jobs or better economy. The George W. Bush tax cuts were specifically premised on the idea that everyone would be better off and the economy would improve. So every year for the 12 years that his tax cuts were in full effect, because remember Obama extended them for 2 years, got Congress to extend them, I track incomes, not government revenues, incomes. Well, the total incomes earned by Americans from 2001 through 2012 were $6.6 trillion less than if we'd stayed at the level of 2000, and Bush said we were going to be better than 2000. It was his chosen year. That is so much money that we could have paid all the income taxes on that money, assumed it was all subject to Social Security taxes. With what was left after taxes, we could pay off every car loan in America, every credit card debt in America, every student loan in America, and every family in America on average would have had over $20,000 in the bank. It was a disaster for workers. From 2000 to 2008, jobs in this country grew at only one-fifth the rate of population. That's one reason people are feeling so stressed. And while incomes started rising again in 2013 and picked up more in 14 and in 15, and we'll have the 2016 data soon, we're still behind the eight ball.
David K. Johnson is our guest. The book is The Making of Donald Trump. David, I remember last time you were on this radio show, and I know that you've said this in other places, that you are trying to come up with your own tax plan that would benefit low and middle-income people here in the U.S. and not favor the corporations. Did I get that right, and how far along are you?
Well, what I've tried to do is create a tax system that is simple, effective, follows all the agreed-upon principles by everybody in tax. You know, John Stossel once had a very right-wing guy and me on his show, and he says 15 minutes into the show, you guys are agreeing on everything just about. And we went, yeah, because the principles of tax people agree on. I've actually finished my what I call the prosperity tax. I recently sat down with a former senior partner, one of the big accounting firms, who's a full professor at a business school and is a tax lawyer, who is unfamiliar with the details of my work. She spent hours running me through my paces, came up with five flaws, three of which we fixed on the spot, another one I fixed on a when I left there and had to take a three-hour drive to give a lecture, and the one that's remaining is an internal IRS issue. But, you know, she at the end of it said, you've done it. You have created a fair, efficient system that promotes investment. It promotes jobs. It rewards people who behave prudently. It's cheat-proof unless you engage in a criminal conspiracy. It's simple. It's easy to implement, and it doesn't do anything that isn't in current law. Everything is just repurposed from current law. And I hope to have that book, which I tentatively call The Prosperity Tax, in print probably in February or March of 2019.
All right. Well, we'll have to get you on the air and talk about that when that happens. Well, one last question, and this is a big one. You write in your book, The Making of Donald Trump, that President Trump, during the years that he was growing his business, if that's the right word, relied in part on ties to organized crime, both domestic organized crime and Russian organized crime. Could you talk about one instance or maybe two instances? We've got about 3 minutes left.
Sure. Well, Donald, when he built Trump Tower, it was one of only two high-class buildings in New York where you could get an apartment without identifying who you were. Now, everybody does this now, but back then they didn't. And so if you came to Donald and said, hi, I want to buy one of your apartments in the name of Snow Inc. in the Cayman Islands. Now, Snow Inc., they wouldn't ask you, is that a ski lodge in California or is that a cocaine business? They would just tell you that, well, yeah, we'll sell you an apartment, but they would set a price that was higher than the market for your anonymity. And Trump Tower has been full of criminals from day one. It's very well known to Interpol, the New York State Organized Crime Bureau, the city's Organized Crime Bureau, the FBI, and others. Donald, when he was in trouble in 2008 and the market collapsed, the real estate market, Donald testified that it was dead, and he said he shouldn't have to pay back a $40 million loan, sold a mansion he bought about 2 miles from Mar-a-Lago for $45 million more than he paid for it. It was bought by one of the Russian oligarchs, who is known, as all of them are, to do the bidding of Vladimir Putin. The argument, the statement publicly was, well, this man was trying to hide money from his wife. If I were trying to hide money from my wife, I wouldn't go pay more than twice what a piece of property is worth. That's throwing it away. In fact, this was part of Putin's campaign. He has been investing in various people all around the world. And think about this the way a venture capitalist does. They decide they're going to put money or do favors or do something with 100 people. 95 of them turn out to be a waste of time. 4 of them turn out to be worth the effort for the other 95. And 1 of them turns into a grand slam home run. In business terms, it would be Amazon. That's what they got with Donald Trump. They hit the jackpot there. And there's deal after deal, I go through a number of them in the book, that make no economic sense, in which Donald got money from the oligarchs. The family has said that they built the golf course empire with Russian money. It was the unregistered foreign agent, Paul Manafort, of Russian interests, who managed the Trump campaign for several months and worked on it for 5. And as somebody who, in the past, many decades ago, I guess about 3.5 decades ago, exposed foreign agents, this is very serious business to be an unregistered foreign agent. So there's a lot there about Trump's connections, but I think the most important one, Rob, is actually the drug trafficker Joseph Wechselbaum. There's a chapter called Showing Mercy and how the mules in the Wechselbaum drug trafficking got up to 20 years in prison. Joe himself, after he pled guilty, had his case transferred to the courtroom of Judge Marianne Trump Berry, Donald's sister. Nobody can explain how that happened because it didn't even take place in the state where she's a federal judge. And while she recused or removed herself from the case, the mules got 20 years. Joe served 18 months, got out of prison, said he had no money to pay his federal fines. He only paid $600 out of tens of thousands.
All right. David K. Johnson.
Into a multimillion-dollar Trump apartment.
David, I'm so sorry we're out of time. Thanks a lot for joining us here on WMNF. David K. Johnson,
thank
the book
you,
is The Make